I'm talking to Ursula Rudenberg, who basically gave us the idea of having a radio station. Ames was ready because the station we'd always thought of as our local station, WOI, had moved its offices to Des Moines. And people were pretty unhappy about that because we were used to being able to have WOI play our concerts or other local things, and suddenly we didn't have that anymore. But I don't think anyone would have thought of starting a radio station if Ursula hadn't come to us and said...
Well, in 2007 was kind of a historic moment in community radio because for the first time in approximately 20 years, it was actually possible to apply to the Federal Communications Commission to get a non-commercial radio license and for that to be a possibility again. It was also, there also weren't that many left in the country because the non-commercial radios are on a limited part of the dial, on the left side of the dial. And so everybody in non-commercial radio world knew that these applications would be more or less the final applications before everything was filled up. And so it was kind of a big moment. The FCC had put a freeze on applications for non-commercial radio licenses because there, with the rise of the religious broadcasters, it had become very difficult and people had become very litigious. A lot of the religious broadcasters were fighting other people that wanted radio licenses. So it got so convoluted and so competitive that the FCC put a freeze on all applications until they came up with a fair scoring system for how to decide who got the licenses and who didn't. And in 2007, they announced a filing window, I think it was in October 2007, that you could apply for a community radio license, or for a nonprofit radio license. And through my work at Pacifica Radio Network, I was in communication with people all over the country that were involved with media democracy movements, and a lot of them were in communication with the FCC, some of them were in Washington, D.C., and they knew that this filing window was coming. And so we organized nationally to get the word out to community groups so that some of these licenses would go to community radio instead of all of them going to the religious broadcasters, which was going to be the big push on their end, too. And so by religious broadcasters, I mean these large religious networks that build up that were ultra-conservative, and some of it was just speculative. They would get these licenses and sell them. So it was kind of a thing going on. And so we wanted to get the word out and make sure that some people would be able to apply for these for non-commercial radio community groups. And so when I saw, we had an engineer make up a map telling us where there were licenses or frequencies still available in the country. And of course, coming from Ames, Iowa, I checked to see whether there was anything in our area, and there was a possibility to apply for a radio frequency here in our area. And so, you know, it was part of my job to let people know about this. It was also a personal, you know, something, it had to do with my personal love for my hometown, too.
Well, I recall that you kind of were pushing me, won't you start a radio station? And my reaction was, no, that's way too much work and money. And then suddenly the money appeared. And I think that was through your contact with Roger Parmenter. How did that happen?
Well, the most important thing was that somebody had to really want to do this in the area. And Roger Parmenter was somebody who was moving to the area, and he was personally motivated to do this. And so Roger was kind of the leader, so to speak, somebody who really would make it his goal in life for a while to make this happen, because it's a relatively arduous process to apply to the FCC for a radio license. The reason I was pushing you was because Roger, in order to apply, Roger needed to apply on behalf, or the application had to come from a nonprofit organization that had been established in the community for a significant period of time. Roger couldn't apply as an individual. And it occurred to me that the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship might be a good place for that. And since you were part of the UU, that's where the push came in terms of talking to you about it. I thought you might be able to help Roger, and you did.
Yes, that was very interesting, because actually I should explain that he came with a lot of money because he had just retired from Hewlett-Packard, and he passionately wanted to start a radio station. So
he sold a lot of his stocks to do it. And again, you don't have to pay the FCC to apply, but you have to pay engineers, you have to pay lawyers, and it does add up, as well as do a lot of work.
Yes, and when I met Roger, for a long time I was dubious. In fact, when we finally got the license, we hardly knew what to do with it. But Roger had, because he was genuinely interested in radio, he had come up with a wonderful broadcast pattern. A lot of broadcast patterns are, you know, kind of like gerrymanders. They're whatever that is available.
Sorry, I was just pointing it towards you because you were kind of going.
And
well, actually, Roger didn't do that. We had I had organized a weekly conference call. We didn't have Zoom in those days. A weekly conference call called Midwest Media, which was for everybody in the Midwest that wanted to apply for, and you don't get a license, you get a permit to construct. The FCC doesn't give you a license till you go on the air, but they assign you a frequency, and they give you a permit to construct a radio station using that frequency. And what happened was actually that Roger initially applied for a frequency here in Ames, and it was great, and we thought we were set. And then at the last minute, KURE applied for that frequency, and because they were already an existing station, they were able to have that. And so then we were like, oh, what are we going to do? And then we realized there was an opening in Story City, and there was another engineer that was part of these telephone calls who was a real radio engineer. He figured out that if we applied for that frequency, you could make it into a circular pattern, which is a much better and less expensive, you know, pattern to have. Like you were saying, it, you know, with other patterns, it goes in and out, in and out. And this was a pattern that was just a large circle around the tower in Story City. And that's why today, I remember when we got the permit from the FCC, coming home from Christmas, I was living in New York at the time, and going to the Unitarian Church, and they were like, why do we have a frequency in Story City? You know, but that's why our ID says Story City Ames, because the frequency actually, the tower is actually in Story City, not in Ames.
Yes, well, last week we told the story of how we got our address of license, mm-hmm. because and there was another technicality. We had to have our address of license in Story City, and nobody in Story City wanted to give it to us, so we went out to Kermit Miskell's farm. Yes. And but we also, Roger did something else that made the circle better. He actually, I guess, bought out a small Christian radio station.
No, he didn't. He didn't buy them out. You want me to tell that story? It's a little bit.
We can cut it out.
Yeah, it's kind of radio, you know, trivia. But okay, so what he did? I mean, Roger was a very good founder. He did good work. He really did, and nobody could really figure out what he was doing. I remember people used to wonder what he was really up to. But he was really doing the right things to build a radio station, or to get one, to get a license, let's put it that way. Okay, so the thing is, when you apply to the FCC, the frequencies don't exist in and of themselves. You have to hire an engineer who comes up with a, well, the frequencies exist, but the patterns, the listener maps, everybody makes their own. So it's kind of like applying for a grant. You make a proposal to the FCC, okay? Now, what happens is that people make proposals that overlap each other. And so then they're competing with each other for the same airspace, right? And that's called being MX'd, which stands for mutually exclusive. In other words, they're both kind of, wanting the same thing. And then the FCC is hoping that people will work it out by themselves and make deals with each other. And if they don't work it out, then the FCC has to play King Midas and decide, King Solomon. The FCC has to decide, who gets the frequency, and everybody gets upset and all that. So, but there's also something really weird. If you picture like the rings of the Olympic symbol that are all, connecting in a row, the frequencies are kind of like that too. In radio applications, that's called the daisy chain, ironically. And so the weird thing is that if the pattern or the area, the listening area that you're proposing, if it overlaps with the ring next to it, the place next to it, according to the FCC, you have to picture you're then mutually exclusive with all of the proposals that are in that whole chain. So even if you're only overlapping with one person, their application, if that person is overlapping with somebody else and that's overlapping with somebody else, then you're competing with all of those people, which is kind of weird and unfair, but that's the way the FCC works. That's called being hooked on a daisy chain. And so the goal is to get yourself unhooked from the daisy chain. Now, the man who was the engineer for KHOI, Michael Brown, he's a fantastic engineer. We at Pacifica provided that for KHOI, for Roger. Michael was very wise, and he noticed that there were two frequencies available in Story City. So he said, apply for both of them. You'll never know how that's going to come in handy. And that's what the people in the UU were asking me, like, why do we have two stations in Story City, right? So what happened was that when the applications came out, it's all on the FCC website, what happened, so you can see who your competitors are. We were connected to a pretty long daisy chain of applications, and the person who was connecting us to all of that was a minister from Minnesota who had applied to our frequency as well as us, 89.1. And he was and if he would go away, everybody else would be disconnected from us because he was the one connecting us to the other proposals. So Roger called him up. And what we also noticed was that his application, based on the evaluation system of the FCC, that his application was weaker than ours, and that if it came to an arbitration with the FCC, he would lose, because he had partly because he wasn't local, and local gives you big points, and partly because he had another radio station, and that also gives you less points. If you're local and it's your first radio station, you get priority. And we had that. So we realized we had a better application, but we didn't have an application that could beat all these other ones that we were hooked up to. And so Roger called up this minister in Minnesota, and he said, I'd really like to talk to you. And the minister said he was driving down to Texas for a wedding, and he came through Ames, I think they met at the Gilbert. There used to be like a diner on the Gilbert corner. They met there. And Roger's a good salesman, that was his profession. And he said, look, if we go head to head, you're gonna lose and you're not gonna get anything. But you are causing us a lot of trouble. Now, we do have this other frequency in Story City that is not competing with anybody. If we give you that frequency, because we had two frequencies, if we give you that frequency, which we had, there was no competition there, we'll give you that if you withdraw 89.1. And that way, you at least get something. Right now, you're not going to get anything because we're going to win. And the minister saw the wisdom in that, and so he agreed. So he dropped his application for 89.1, and we gave him the other frequency in Story City, and I don't know what he did with it. I've never followed that up. I don't know if he built a station or not. So we didn't buy anything, but we did make a deal with him, and he cooperated, and that was in 2009. In 2007 was the application. And then we sat there for 2 years because we were in competition with other people. In 2009, Roger made this arrangement with this minister. The minister dropped it, and the FCC was delighted because they didn't have to deal with it, and they gave us the permit right away.
Well, it's pretty wonky, but I think it's very interesting because it's not simply a matter of saying, oh, we want to start a radio station, we'll just fill out some paperwork and do it.
Right.
It was a lot. And when we're talking about Roger, I'd really like to give him another bit of credit because he worked to make our station known. I mean, this was before we were even on the air.
Yeah.
He'd go to county fairs. He'd go speak to Kiwanis clubs. And I've still, every so often, I'll run into somebody who said, KHOI, yes, Roger Parmenter talked to us, or there was this guy who talked to us at our morning meeting once.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was really, he knew what to do.
Yeah, he did a good job. Yeah.
Well, let's jump
in. It was pretty thankless. I remember people being very suspicious of him and kind of like, what does this person want? You know, what is he doing? You know, and then I remember, you know, I used to say to people, well, you know, we're making a radio station. And then people would say, well, how do I hear this radio station? And, you know, you'd say, well, you'll be able to turn on the radio. And like, yeah, but how do you hear your radio? You know, they didn't believe that this was like a real radio station.
Well, there were times when I didn't believe we were ever going to turn it on. That's next week's program with Paul Nelson. There were lots of heroes along the way.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But you were the one with the overall vision because you'd been through this. And
actually, I'd never been through it. I was working in community radio, so I knew what it was, but this was all new to me too. But I was connected with people all over the country who knew what they were doing, and so I was able to, you know, figure it out and get the help we needed. And when we finally, you know, built the tower and the tower site, which is a big operation. When you finally put all your stuff on the tower, you know, we had people come from other parts of the country who were part of Pacifica Network who came and, like, got the job done.
Well, while we're giving thank yous, I'd also like to give a thank you to the First Baptist Church because we, as we were waiting for our permit so that we could actually start to broadcast, we did some trial broadcasting on the internet, and we had a studio and we had a schedule, and you'll hear from some of the people who worked on that, and it was on the third floor of the education wing of the First Baptist Church, but they were so generous. They gave us a space for our studio, and they gave us a place for our break room. It was their break room also, but it was a good place for a board meeting or just a place to get away from the heat of the equipment.
Mm-hmm.
But, of course, it certainly wasn't handicap accessible.
Mm-hmm.
It was up three flights of stairs.
Mm-hmm.
But I just...
Yeah. Go ahead.
Well, I don't remember the name of the person. I can paste mm-hmm. that in later.
Yeah.
Who told me, yes. And they just gave us a key to unlock the church. Oh, yes. That's later in the story because this is before the Pantorium.
Yeah.
No. But then, of course, after we left the not handicap accessible First Baptist Church, we were looking for a place to have our studio. Mm-hmm. And as you know, that's pretty hard in downtown Ames. And Ursula Rudenberg has a story about how she found the Pantorium.
Well, we were in the Baptist Church. We were on the third floor. And at your and several other people's request, I came to Ames about three quarters of a year before our deadline. The FCC gives you a deadline for going on the air, and we had we were pretty much up against it. And my assignment was to get this thing on the air. And I felt very strongly that the first step towards doing that is that the KHOI had to be very, very visible, that it needed a so we needed to raise about $100,000 within about 9 months, and which is basically was a fundraising campaign. And so in order to do that successfully, we needed visible headquarters. So I wanted a building that was on the ground floor in a busy part of town where everybody could see us and where people could come and go and you could have coffee with your neighbors, and that just that we, you know, were visible to the community, because 9 months is a pretty short turnaround for raising that kind of money. And for a project that nobody really understood, right? And so I started looking for a building that had very high visibility, and doesn't get much better than the Pantorium when it comes to iconic buildings in town. And so we were incredibly lucky. I had personal connections to the Pantorium because back in the 1970s, my sister, Ames High had a free school for about a year or two. And my sister went there, my younger sister, Annette. And so I had spent a lot of time up there. And I lived nearby on Douglas Avenue at 622 Douglas. So I lived right up the block from there. And I noticed that the Pantorium was empty. The dry cleaners had moved out about half a year before this. And the building was empty. And on my sister's encouragement, she encouraged me to go and check it out. And so I went down to the Pantorium, and you know, she felt that I should do it because we, you know, this was a building we loved and we had spent a lot of time in, and we should go be there again, you know. And so I drove down to the Pantorium. It was on a Sunday, and Dennis Jones, the owner, and his wife were in there cleaning. The building still hadn't been cleaned out. And they were pretty depressed. It was a lot of work. And they saw me press my nose up against the window. And so they came and talked to me, and they said, "What do you want?" And I said, "I'd like to rent this building." And Dennis did that. He rented it to us. And I think we were just incredibly lucky that he... I know he got a lot of offers after he said we could rent it, and he was very faithful to us, and he was true to his word. He gave it to us at a very, very, very fair price, and was the sweetest landlord imaginable. Dennis Jones he was the operations manager for the animal disease lab out on east of town. And he had bought this as a kind of a retirement project. He was interested in restoring the building to its historic beauty, and he let us be in there. And he was a wonderful friend to us, even though I think he probably got some grief from it from some of his friends, because he was a pretty, you know, staunch conservative, and our station's profile doesn't always really go along with that. But he was true to his word. He was a wonderful friend. He came, and he was a member of the station, donated money to it, and he came, and it was a beautiful thing. And then we didn't have the money to build a studio until a year later. So for a year, we didn't have a studio. We kind of built this strange little, you know, infamously known as the tent, where we just hung some quilts from the ceiling and used that as a studio. And then about a year later, we had a large donor who I think has asked to remain anonymous, who paid for a studio. And so then we were able to build a studio a year later.
Dennis applied for a facade grant because originally when it was a dry cleaners, they had plywood in the lower half of the windows. Mm-hmm. And so he applied for this grant, and I think it included these full windows and also an awning.
I remember I have pictures, or we have pictures of when he knocked those front windows out and he was sitting on the couch looking, you know, out the empty hole in his building. It's very sweet. Yeah. But I had a very sweet conversation with Dennis, because a few days after we talked on that Sunday, I called him up and I said, Dennis, I'd like to have coffee with you. Because I thought, well, that was a little bit too easy, you know. And so we met at Cafe DM and we sat down, and he was so funny. He sat down and he said to me, okay, I looked you up, I Googled you, and you have to know that I'm politically opposed to everything that you seem to stand for. And I said, yeah, I had a feeling, that, you know, that's why I wanted to have coffee with you, but I said, but you seem to be the kind of person who is willing to talk to people that you disagree with. And we ended up having an absolutely lovely conversation, and he gave us the building. And, you know, when he could have done better, he could have gotten more money for it. And I've always wondered, like, why was Dennis so faithful to us? And I think it's because, I don't know, some people may don't know, Dennis was very involved with fixing bicycles and, you know, repurposing them for people in the community. I think Dennis was very, very dedicated to community. And he really shared that with KHOY. He really, even though I think politically he was a little bit confused by us, or sometimes probably offended, but he understood that at heart this was about community. It wasn't about a political position, you know, or a particular group of people in town. That we were, you know, genuinely building a community organization that was trying to bring people together. And he got that. And he was that kind of person too. And I think that's what he shared with us. He was just a super lovely man.
And we made sure that nobody got into the bike storage section of the building where people could, bring the bikes that were waiting to be repaired.
Yeah, I mean, it was a fantastic campaign headquarters because it was so visible. You know, if people asked you where you were, you didn't have to say, well, you know, this building up this block at the corner. So all you had to say is, we're at the Ames Pantorium, and with the iconic sign. And it's such an adorable building anyway. I mean, it always looked to me like a cartoon character with a big smile. It just couldn't have been a more lovable place to be. And, you know, when I grew up, the building was in very bad shape, so I always thought of it as kind of like a rundown place. But the truth is, once Dennis started to renovate it, it really was revealed what a beautiful, you know, piece of architecture this building is. It had been built by an Iowa State architecture professor, and it, you know, was built for light and beauty. And Dennis really brought that back very quickly. Another thing that kind of has to be said was, you know, it's really remarkable because, I mean, it was an industrial space when we moved in. And then as we were building, we moved upstairs for a while. We moved in the front window for a while. Quiet, please. We're saying something on the, you know, it was just like amazing that there were parties. We did everything, you know, in the same room, and everybody cooperated with each other. It was amazing that we actually were able to, you know, to get that done. It was really something. But the Roger was actually unhappy about the decision to go to the Pantorium, and for one really good reason, which was the downtown is very low altitude. Downtown Ames used to be a swamp, so it's very low. Campus Town is higher. And we did not have line of sight to our radio tower from the Pantorium, which made life difficult for us. So that's why today we have an internet based, and, you know, so we're using cell phone technology to connect to our tower because we never could get that line of sight that we need to see our tower. So that was a drawback that actually caused many nights and days of grief for Paul Nelson. That was the trade-off. I mean, I did talk to a lot of people in community radio and asked them, you know, what is more important, line of sight to your tower or a really good community space? And everybody said, you're in the business of community radio, you need a good community space. That's what you need. And that comes first. Technology can always adjust, but, you know, you have to have that. And the Pantorium could not have been better for that. It was a great place.